Okay, everyone, welcome back to Design and Implementation with yours truly, Craig Andera and Tim Ewald.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, and for those of you that are here for the first time, welcome to you as well. All right, so let's jump right in. What we'd like to do is start with a segment that we call, in this case, Question from Listener. We had one question this time from our last show, which where we talked a little bit about REST and SOAP and various architectural styles. And so I'd like to encourage people to send in questions. You can post them right on the as comments on the blog entry where you got the link for this show. We'll try to get to them as many of them as we reasonably can. We don't want to spend too much time on these because we'd like to get right to the meat of this show. But let's go ahead and start with a question from last time. All right, Tim, I think I'll let you answer this question. I'll go ahead and read it here. It came from Jay McGaffigan, who says, from listening, I guess I'm still grappling with the whole transaction as a first-class citizen in the REST world concept. I think my major malfunction comes from having trouble breaking free of the, quote, RPC paradigm in the case of complex writes. REST makes a lot of sense to me in read and CRUD-oriented systems. However, getting into the state transitioning and complex writes still hurts my head some. So maybe you can address that quickly.
So I was thinking a lot about this question. I think maybe my best example of a way to think about it or an analogy is actually to think about a specific problem domain, which is banking. So when we think about dealing with a bank and manipulating accounts, so I have a series of accounts, and in a REST world, I might think of those as resources that I can modify. But when I'm doing banking transactions, so deposits, withdrawals, or transfers, clearly in that problem space, those processes that I'm performing are an implicit part of the problem domain, right? So it's important that I can go back and get a list of all deposits and withdrawals and transfers. Those processes that change the state of my accounts are things in their own right that I care about. I care because at the end of the month, I need to be able to go through a bank statement and reconcile my own records with the bank's records. So if I were to envision a REST interface for manipulating accounts, I don't think it would be just let me read the representation of an account object, change its state, and put it back. It would be, I need to create a new deposit, which is a persistent resource in its own right, because I need to be able to come back and, you know, see those later on. And then by putting that deposit into the system, that's going to affect a certain account, or in the case of a transfer, it's going to affect multiple accounts. So that's the basic idea of a change, which, you know, from an RPC perspective, we might think of as a method invocation. But it's an example of a change being treated as a durable resource in the system. And in the case of a banking system, they'd be durable for a really long time. So the interesting question is, can you abstract that concept and use it in other situations where the problem domain itself might not call for the change you're making to be a durable thing in its own right? But maybe we could leverage that as a way to build systems or that have the benefits of REST, but reconcile it with a problem domain that's more process-oriented than thing-oriented. I don't know if that's less vague than what we said before, hopefully.
No, I think that makes some good sense. I mean, really, it's about, and I understand why people might have a hard time getting into this, because it's really about the mindset of REST, right? Is what do you want to make your resources?
Yeah, I think an ongoing theme in the work that both you and I are doing and many other people are doing involves how we reconcile this resource-oriented view of the world and the more process-oriented view of the world. And that seems to be one of the big splits today between people who are thinking about REST and people who are thinking about SOAP. And it seems like there ought to be a way to coalesce the two.
Right. Well, and if we figure out any great insights, you'll certainly hear about it here. But I think hopefully that addresses the question somewhat. But I think maybe we should move on and talk about our main topic for today, which is actually some work that I have been doing recently based around a system that that I've blogged about before, that I've written about before, and that Tim and I actually worked together on a few years ago. So, and that system is the MTPS system, which underlies the MSDN2 website. If you've ever been to the MSDN website to look at the developer documentation, you've seen the work of our hands. Tim was a key force in getting that designed and implemented, and I wrote some of the code back there too. I've blogged about a little bit before about how I wrote a SOAP service for that to access that information. You can actually go and write a SOAP client right now to go and retrieve all of the information, almost all of the information, I should say, that's out in the MTPS, the Microsoft TechNet Publishing System, and pull it down and manipulate it however you want. If you've ever heard of an open source project called Sandcastle, it uses that web service to build custom doc sets, custom CHMs, I believe, to do it, you know, to work with that information. So the work that I've done recently and that we want to talk about today, kind of a nice follow-on from our talk last time, is that I've actually in the process right now of developing a REST API to the same information. So I thought maybe what we would do today is have turn the tables a little bit and have Tim maybe ask me some questions about the design and implementation of that system. So I know Tim has a bunch of things he was going to ask me, so I'll go ahead and flip it over to you, Tim.
So the very first thing that I've been wanting to ask is what the motivation for this change is. I mean, you built a SOAP-based service that was published, and as I recall, you blogged numbers about how much load that thing gets, and it's high.
Yeah, it's like
used a lot.
It is. We looked at the numbers, and we were totally surprised to find that, you know, I forget the exact numbers, but it's something like half of the traffic that the MSDN to website itself gets. So it's, you know, it's something like on the order of a million requests a day. It's pretty high load. And so
right. So okay. So you have a SOAP-based service out there. It's working. It's being used by Sandcastle. Is it used by PackageThis?
Yes.
Okay, so it's used by a couple pretty popular tools that developers are leveraging in their work. What's the motivation for moving on and doing a REST version if it's going to do the same thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the first thing I want to point out and make this really apparent is that what we've got out, this service is actually live right now. The URL you can go to if you want to check out this this REST service is lab.msdn.microsoft.com/REST API stubs. And that's lab, L-A-B. And REST API stubs is R-E-S-T-A-P-I-S-T-U-B-S. No spaces or dashes or anything. Anyway, you can go and look at it right now. But it's a prototype. I just want to make this clear before we go any farther. This is, hey, we're thinking about doing things this way. Here are some thoughts we had. You know, take a look. Let us know what you think. We are going to be changing it. The thing that's out there right now is by no means done, but we thought, you know, let's get it out there and see what people think. You know, get an idea of the design we're trying to use. But, you know, if you use it, just be aware that this is very much there's a reason it's on the lab.msdn.microsoft.com domain. This is totally an incubation thing. But to come back to your question of why did we do this, really this came out of, so when I wrote the SOAP web service, you know, we did it and, you know, it was we got it to the point where it was totally usable. But like any piece of software, it's never done. And as we were looking down the road to the things that we wanted to do with it, one of the questions was, well, how do you make this reasonable for a client to work with so that they don't have to go and hit the service every single time they want a piece of information? You know, you want to be able to do things like caching, you know, when does content expire, you know, things like this, right? Just sort of performance tweaks. And as I looked at it, I said, wow, those things are already in HTTP. I mean, you look at things like if modified since header and the expiration headers, you know, all these caching related headers, e-tags, big one. And I said, well, I could certainly bake something like that into the SOAP service. But then what we have is essentially HTTP over SOAP over HTTP. Now, couple that with some of the things that we talked about last time as far as my own personal revelation of what scenarios SOAP is appropriate for and what scenarios REST is appropriate for. And I went to, and I talked to the project team over there, and I said, you know, I think this actually makes sense as a REST service, because really, you know, it's a content management system, right? It's you know, you're going and retrieving documents. What a great fit for HTTP. So why do we want
There's an understatement.
Yeah, exactly, right? Why do we want soap, and I'll say in the way, right? Not as a pejorative, but just, you know, it's additional layers that are going to make me re-implement stuff that's already there. And, you know, like I said, we were interested in doing a prototype. Well, what better place to try out the idea and see how it fits, right, than, okay, well, we've got an idea to prototype the next generation of features. Let's go ahead and prototype this, you know, change in architectural style as well. So really, it's just the idea of, this looks like a really good fit. We have an opportunity to try it out. Let's go ahead and try it out.
Okay, so this new service exposes the same functionality. Is it the same functionality as the previous one? Is it more? Is it less?
At the current time, it is. I think it's fair to say it's a little bit more. It's really, the sets are what do you call it? They're not completely disjoint. There's many things that are in both, some things that are in one, and a very few things that are in the other. If you know what I mean. So you can walk up to the web service, and actually, I would recommend that if you're interested in playing with it, just pull up a browser, point it at lab.msdn.microsoft.com/REST-API-stubs, and the way I've set it up is that the whole thing is designed so that you can actually look at the information in a browser. Now, it's not pretty, right? It's not designed to be visually pleasing. It's designed to be easily read by a computer. The one thing that I have done that's a little bit different than many REST APIs is that instead of returning a custom XML grammar, if you're familiar with the SOAP service at all, you know that we define a bunch of XML grammars for things like content items and things like information about links, paths, you know, the navigation information. What I've done is everywhere that we return information, with one exception in the REST API, the information is returned as XHTML. Right, so instead of, you know, having a tag like author, you know, that doesn't mean anything in XHTML, I've actually used div with a class of author. Right, now what that means is that you can look in your browser and get a fairly reasonable view of the information. You know, it's not pretty. If you right click and say view source, you'll see that it's really, you know, kind of more structured data, computer oriented, but it's good enough that you can actually go and start clicking through. So if you go to that homepage,
one of the things I absolutely love about that approach is that from a perspective of a developer who wants to use a service, being able to pick it up and understand it, being able to walk up to it in a browser and essentially just manipulate it directly and have it produce output forms that you can read, even if they're not beautiful, as you say. But the important part is you can walk through all the interactions, you can see what the URIs are that are being used, and just kind of how all those pieces work. It's fantastic for ramping up on a service. It's also extremely useful for testing. If there's some scenario where you think your application's not doing the right thing, you could always switch to a browser and just manipulate the interface directly and see whether you're getting the desired effect and sort of the divide and conquer, right? Is it something I'm doing wrong in how I'm interpreting it, or is it actually a problem with the service that I don't understand some aspect of its interface, or it's actually not functioning correctly? But the trade-off for that, to get it to work seamlessly in the browser, as you just mentioned, is the fact that you use XHTML as the output format, and you use essentially some semantic meaning to the class names that you tag elements with. So from the consumption perspective, you know, I guess one of my concerns would be people used to, certainly SOAP web services with a schema definition and a WSDL definition behind them, have a straightforward mapping, or often a straightforward mapping to code, although sometimes not, as you get more flexible things. And certainly in the case of MTPS, where the data inside it that you're accessing is only semi-structured, it doesn't map particularly well to an object model. How do you see people consuming this? I mean, are you concerned at all that someone writing code against this is going to have to tease apart XHTML, and how do you, what could you do that would make that easier?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that was kind of the only drawback to the XHTML was kind of the client piece, right? So I give you a pile of XHTML, and what do you do with it? Ordinarily, I'd give you a pile of XML, and my personal favorite API, and I think it's yours too, is XML Serializer, right? I would, you know, write a bunch of objects and annotate them with attributes, and it would, you know, turn a pile of XML into something that I could access with dot notation. Now, the story pre.NET 3.5 for working with XHTML out of the box really isn't that great. But one of the things I was fortunate to be able to do here was to be able to use .NET 3.5. And as part of my development for this, I did test-driven development. And so I wound up having to work with the XHTML from a client perspective a lot as I wrote my test to verify that what I thought should be coming out of a particular URL was in fact coming out of that URL. And what I found was that the classes and stuff in Xlink, if you just write a little bit of wrapper code, you get a pretty decent way of accessing XHTML. I mean,
we should be clear, this is Xlink, L-I-N-Q, not Xlink, the W3C spec that's of undetermined destination.
Right, right. The new feature, the new language integrated query features with the XML features from .NET 3.5. Although honestly, the stuff I did, although things like extension methods make it a little bit more handy, it's not like you couldn't whip up a library that would make it fairly easy to do things like say, and of course it's difficult to write code in a podcast, but to say things like you know, div dot with class author dot with child span dot with class foo. You know what I mean? You could really develop, I think fairly easily, develop a library that would make it pretty natural to work with XHTML, particularly because the XHTML I ultimately wound up using is a pretty constrained format. It's essentially just divs, spans, and A's, right, anchor tags. There are a few places right now where we're currently using some other stuff like list, you know, the li tag, the ordered list and unordered list. But I will probably go back and rip that out after having. It was one of the things I wrote early on. So I.
But just as an aside here, and talking to you as you built this thing, you were doing a lot of your work in Link, and so I agree that historically both you and I have really favored XML serializer, although often hand rolling the classes as opposed to generating them. But it seems like you've got a new favorite XML API in Link.
Definitely, absolutely. I really, really like Xlink. It just, I think that the thing that it does is it sort of, although it's not a perfect replacement for XPath, XSLT, and XML serializer, it does enough of each of those things that it becomes a really good default tool. And there's a lot to be said for keeping your tool set small, right? The fewer languages and tools that you have to pull in, the better.
So switching gears a little bit, having talked about what the payload is, in terms of producing this, you know, so let's talk, we just touched on the client side and consumption of this, and it sounds like there are some downsides to using XHTML as a format, but it fits naturally with this problem domain, and it works in the browser, which is, again, a great characteristic, and there are tools out there that the adventurous client programmer can use. How about on the implementation side? How different was this from the implementation you did from the SOAP Web Services? How hard was it to write?
Oh, it was quite a bit easier, in fact. The big disadvantage of the Link stuff is that there's no streaming model. But, you know, given that this is a prototype, we weren't too concerned with performance at this stage. Mm-hmm. So I just went with, XDocument, and I wrote, like I said, some simple wrapper classes. So I could say things like, if I wanted to produce a div that contained a span that contained an anchor tag, I would just say xhtml.div, open paren, xhtml.span, open paren, xhtml.a, open paren, and then fill it in with whatever the anchor tag was going to contain, close paren.
So you're building an XDocument object model on the server to create the output.
Yeah.
Okay. So it'll be interesting to see whether, as the system goes under load, that becomes an issue or not.
Yeah, I think there's actually some possibility because of things like lambdas in C# 3.0 that you could actually do a delayed execution model that would give you a lot of the same semantics in terms of the code you write, but would have characteristics, performance characteristics, more like a streaming model. But that would be a change, obviously, to what I'm doing
sure.
now.
So how about the rest of the infrastructure? I mean, when you build a SOAP-based web service, there's all of... I mean, I remember the very original prototype of the first set of services. It was actually ASMX-based, and then there was a move towards WCF as that came along. What's the underlying plumbing? Ignoring how the payload's generated, you know, what's the rest of the model for this system as you had to build up a whole set of dynamic URLs that traverse the MTPS data store. know, how did you implement that piece?
I wound up doing my own MVC implementation, built on top of very, very low-level ASP.NET. I mean, it's the only ASP.NET code is really a single IHTTP handler that handles every single request. There's a star mapping that just sends everything to that thing. And then inside there, I wrote a little router that looks at the URL, and I built up a series of classes that, you know, take the path that comes in and breaks it down into the segments. So, you know, slash content, slash system.xml, .xml reader, and it'll break that up into pieces. And then, you know, I just compare them. I have a series of a little syntax that I wrote essentially in a table that you can say, and when I say syntax, I mean it's C#. It's not, I didn't write some custom language in a parser. It's actually something like, you know, dispatch table entry, and then inside there it contains a stuff like a compound segment matcher, which is my way of saying this is a URL with several segments, things separated by slashes. And then it says what each one has to match to. And then at the end of that dispatch table entry, there's a type, and that type is something that implements renderer. Now this will sound really familiar to anyone that's worked with any MVC framework before. The reason I didn't use the ASP MVC framework was that when I started this back in September, that stuff wasn't public. So I wrote my own, and I found that it was easy. It was, you know, it was non-trivial, but it was pretty easy to write something that works pretty well. It's just MVC is fundamentally a pretty simple concept, so that's how it's.
And it sounds like potentially you could, if you wanted to, you could move to the new ASP.NET MVC framework at some point when it's further along, or you're prepared to, or you have more cycles to do that work. I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be a big shift.
Well, I haven't really had a chance to really look into it, so I'd hesitate to commit to that. But I doubt that it would be a big deal. I mean, certainly it's going to be.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was focusing more on the design side than the implementation. So, you know, from the design perspective, the shift is already done, and I'm wondering what's taking you so long.
Right. Yeah. Well. So, Tim, I'm glad you're not my manager, I guess.
So have you talked to any of the projects that are using the existing API? I mean, do people know this is coming, and do you have any plans? Is there anyone, you know, rubbing their hands together with glee at the prospect of this coming out? Is it going to enable something that they weren't going to be able to do before? In fact, in particular, is it going to enable the ability to write back? I know that there's features like annotations, comments, things like that, that the system supports under the covers and is used from the public website. Is that stuff getting surfaced in the API?
Yeah, so there's about three questions you just asked me. The first one is there anybody that I know of that's going to be using this REST API? We do have one project that is making heavy use of this. I don't think it's been publicly announced yet, so I won't say more about that
right
now. So
that's an internal project of some sort.
Yes, although I'm pretty sure there's plans to surface it at some point. Anyway, but enough. Other than that, I don't actually know of anyone who's planning to use the REST API. Now, your third question, I believe, was, are we surfacing any data that's not currently available through the SOAP
API? Or any functionality.
Or any functionality, right. And the answer is, yes, we are. Specifically, there's quite a bit, actually. If you look at the... when you land at the top-level URL, the lab.msdn.microsoft.com/REST-API-stubs, you'll see that there's kind of a little roadmap there. It gives you links to all of the things that are going to be surfaced. And if you look at that, it says let me just pull it up real quick. I can remember off the top of my head. But it's content, so that's where you would get all of the, you know, documentation-type stuff like, I want to know what system.xml reader does. Docs, which is documentation for the service. Hey, it's a prototype. Don't expect too much there. Sites, which is going to be information about... So there's actually several websites at Microsoft that use this. There's TechNet and MSDN are the two main ones. So you'll be able to get information about those. And then the big one, I think, for people, and this one that's new, is community. So the community includes two big things. One is tags, and one is annotations. Tags will be familiar to anyone that's ever used anything like Delicious, right? And this is something that actually exists right now today. Not everybody knows this, but you can go to the MSDN website and you can sign in with your passport and tag an item. You know, you can tag it with, oh, this is about threading, or you can tag it with whatever you want, right? And there's a whole tag cloud and everything. And that information is exposed through the SOAP API. Additionally, you can annotate items, right? You can walk up and say, oh, you know, Although the documentation says that this thing isn't thread safe, I've used it heavily in my application and found out that it was no big deal as long as you did whatever, right? And there's a bunch of annotations that people have put out there, not as much as we'd like to see eventually, right? But it is there, and it's exposed through the REST API. Here's the thing, okay? Big caveat. Like I said, this is a prototype. We are still working on it. Right now, if you go to the REST API and click on the the tags and annotations, you get synthetic data. Right now, I'm a consultant. I work at my home in Virginia, and so I don't have like access to the MTPS database. It would have been a big pain to do that. So I developed this against fake data that I whipped up, right? Just like synthetic data. And that's what you're going to get right now. We're actually working like today, as we speak. I'm not saying it's going to be done today, but as we speak, we are working on switching that over so that it hits the real annotation data that comes out of the MTPS database. And that should be, available before too much longer.
So is the REST API going to enable you to write annotations? Because as I recall, the SOAP API was entirely read.
The SOAP API is entirely read. Right now, the REST API is entirely read. However, we have had design discussions about adding write capability. Some complications there, right? I mean, there's just the things we have to figure out in terms of, if we expose an API for blasting spam into the MTPS database, we have to make sure that there's some way to counter that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So not exposed right now, but it is something that we're thinking about.
Definitely a topic for future conversation.
Absolutely.
So as this thing gets ready to go live, it sounds like once it's wired up to the actual MTPS database, is there, it would still be running on lab, which is prototype stuff. Is there a longer-term plan for, do you see this replacing the SOAP interface or expect both of them to be there because there are things using the SOAP interface in the field right now? I mean, what's the long-term story?
I don't know. I really don't. I mean, to some degree, I'm just a code monkey. I designed the REST interface, but I don't know what the kind of strategic direction is, or even if
I think
if
you
there
sell yourself short, Craig. I think you're actually more of a code gorilla.
Yeah, is that GUER or GOR?
Either one.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Both. Yeah. I don't know. I really don't. That's something that I think part of the reason to put it up on labs is to get some feedback and help make those decisions.
Yeah, it'll definitely be interesting to see who picks it up and what they try to do with it. As I said before, I'm super interested in hearing people's opinion of a service interface that's surfaced in the browser as well as programmatically, because I think it's one of the concerns about REST interfaces that folks I talk to ask is, well, where's the description of it, right? Where's the WSDL definition? They've been sort of pre-programmed to that from the SOAP world, and of course there isn't one. Many of us see that as a benefit. I think the interesting thing is that in the classic SOAP-based web service, the WSDL definition was never sufficient. There was always documentation to go along with it, and so most of the existing REST APIs out in the world, if you go look at GData from Google or the various Amazon web services, the documentation is English prose on a website somewhere. And I think this really opens the door to potentially combine those two into one thing. I guess one of the interesting steps to go down that path is, what if you had a situation where you didn't want to expose XHTML as the payload for programmatic access? I'm pretty curious about, could I build an implementation of a REST interface that, if you were coming from a browser, exposed XHTML so you could walk through the whole process, but if you were coming from some other application and were getting XML formats back, it would essentially use all the same endpoints. It would just process different input and output formats. And how difficult would that be to do? Or does the whole world move to XHTML as the format of choice?
I don't think we'll ever get the whole world to be XHTML as the format of choice, just because, we can't settle on one of anything.
Sure.
Right? There's no one of anything. But I will
say
this.
Okay, so not the whole world, but a chunk of the world. Can you imagine, the aforementioned banking application we talked about at the top of the show, using XHTML as its payload for defining withdrawals and deposits, etc.? Or do you think that's just too out there for people likely to be designing those systems?
Well, you know, you say, is it too out there? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, every time I tell someone I'm using HTML, I definitely get XHTML, I get skepticism.
Yeah.
It seems a little bit crazy, but if you think about it, I mean, if your format is not using like really wacky XML constructs, then the transformation between XHTML divs and, you know, divs and classes and spans and classes, and an XML grammar that consists of you know, just elements with attributes and textual content, you know, you could write that XSLT, right? It's not fundamentally different. It's just a different way of writing it down that has the benefit of, I think there's actually, I should say there is one fundamental difference, right? One of the key things that I tried to do with this REST API was not just simply to express the data as XHTML so you could see it in a browser, but, and this was actually a little hard to pull off, was to make sure that any relationships between items were expressed as hrefs, right? Anchor tags with an href.
Right.
And I mean, I know you know that the reason that's important is that it allows existing tools, I mean, for example, Google, although I suppose I should say Live Search, you know, that walks up to the service can discover relationships between items because it understands XHTML and it understands specifically the anchor tag, even if it knows nothing about the data format itself. Now, that's something that you don't get when you have a custom XML grammar where you say, I don't know, relate. You know, you have a relationship tag with an attribute that is ID ref, and where the contents of that ID ref attribute are some ID, and you have to know the algorithm for how to resolve that to some other piece of XML.
Right.
And that was key for me, and that's actually one of the things that I want to go back and fix up a little bit, is that not everywhere in the REST API where there exists a relationship between two resources do I have a link. I try to do it a lot, but there's a few places where I could add it in.
I mean,
more.
You could adopt the href style for referencing things inside a custom dialect.
Of course. But,
but
the problem
is... the point's well taken that there are tools that could process this and potentially come up with interesting results because it's XHTML.
Right. I should say, by the way, that you mentioned, you know, could you have a non-XHTML data coming out of the service? Actually, there's two kinds of non-XHTML data already coming out of the service. At request, I added what's called a raw content item endpoint. If you walk up to, I don't think it's in the one that's out there on the public web service right now, but I've got the code written and checked in. We'll need to roll it out at some point. Like I said, we're going to be updating the service. If you go to a content item, there will eventually be a link for a raw view of this content item, which is actually just in an XML format. And the reason that's there is actually to support some... it's a format that Microsoft uses for some internal tools, currently with the SOAP web service, but the idea is to have at least a conceptual bridge.
Right.
The other place where we produce non-XML is images, right? I mean, obviously, if you walk up to a piece of documentation, an image can be an important part of the documentation, and we do support returning images. So, you know, it's there as well.
So we have come to the close of just about half an hour.
Yeah.
Which feels like a good length for an episode.
I think so. All right. Well, thanks for your questions, Tim. I think they were good. I'm sure that I certainly hope that people have more questions. As I said before, we'd certainly encourage you to drop a comment with your question. Just drop it on the blog entry where you saw this, the link to this episode, and we will get back to you either on the blog or you know, maybe at the beginning of the next episode.
And we'd especially love feedback on an input into this whole question of how important is browser-based access to a service as a way to discover and understand it. That's independent of whether it always uses XHTML or only sometimes. Right?
Well, that's
two
absolutely.
Separate questions, and we're very curious what people think about that.
Yeah, and as one more plug, I'm personally very curious about the service itself, right? If anybody winds up using this or has feedback about the design or anything, please let me know that as well. That'd be great. It's one of the reasons we're throwing it out there. And again, the blog's a good way to contact me about that. So, well, I think that wraps it up for this time. So until next time, I will say goodbye and thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody.
All right. We'll catch you later.